Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And today we'll spend much of this show with the latest on what you need to know about COVID-19 and efforts to stop the spread. The White House announced the U.S.-Canada border is the latest crossing to close as part of those efforts. This is under mutual consent between the U.S. and Canadian governments. Only essential travel will be allowed, and President Trump says trade will not be impacted. NPR science correspondent Rob Stein joins us now to answer some of your most urgent questions about all of this. And Rob, we're tracking the breaking news. And one piece of developing news that a lot of people still want guidance on is testing for this virus. Where do we stand on the government's promise to ramp up, and who can get tested and how fast?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, we still don't have nearly enough testing available in this country, but it is finally starting to ramp up. More than 58,000 tests have been done, and thousands of tests are now being done every week as more labs come online and more tests become available. We've even finally started to see some of those, you know, drive-through pop-up test sites that we've been hearing about open up all around the country. And some of the newer tests that can produce results within hours are coming online, but the turnaround time varies a lot because of all sorts of things. You know, labs can get backed up, so it can still take a day or two to get results. And public health experts say the U.S. still has a long way to go to get enough testing up and running to try to catch up with the virus, and, you know, which is we really need that to get the outbreak under control.
Yeah. Another question that we've been hearing a lot from the audience is about how they can take care of themselves at home. And people have been hearing warnings that they should not take over-the-counter painkillers like ibuprofen. Is that true?
Yes. So there's been a lot of conflicting information about that. That idea seems to have started because of a warning by the French health minister who told people not to take ibuprofen because it could make, you know, COVID-19, the disease caused by this virus, worse. But most of the experts that we've been talking to are saying there's really no good scientific evidence to back that up, no good evidence that there's something unusual about this virus that would make taking ibuprofen a bad idea. You know, it's important to remember that fever is part of the body's natural response to any infection.
Right.
So it's always the case that reducing a fever, you know, may interfere with the body's natural response to fight off an infection. So there's always that balancing act that you don't want a fever to go too high where it's dangerous, but some fever can help. But so far, we don't know anything that's special about this virus and ibuprofen.
Yeah. Yeah. Another big question that we keep hearing over and over, we can't state enough, is to get clarity on this. Can you catch the virus by touching something? How long does it survive on surfaces? And should we be worried about bringing packages or mail inside of the house?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And in fact, a study just came out this week in the New England Journal of Medicine that addresses that question. And it says that, you know, this virus can survive on stuff for days. You know, specifically, this study showed that it can stay alive on hard surfaces, you know, like plastic and stainless steel for up to 72 hours and on cardboard for up to 24 hours. So, you know, that's important because when an infected person sneezes or coughs, droplets that carry the virus can land on things like doorknobs, elevator buttons, handrails, countertops, and spread the virus to anyone who touches them. So, you know, it's important, though, to remember that this study was conducted at a federal lab, not under real-world conditions. So this may vary depending on things like temperature, humidity, you know, how much light there is. So there's still a lot we don't know about how long it survives on things, you know, like clothing and carpet. But, you know, it's important to remember that you can't kill the virus by wiping it down with, you know, alcohol and ammonia and stuff like that.
Okay, very quickly, we received a question from a listener about blood banks. A lot of them are experiencing shortages because blood drives are being canceled. Is it safe to donate blood right now?
So the Red Cross is aware of these problems and saying, you know, there is a concern about shortage, but it is safe to donate blood. They're taking lots of precautions. People who are taking blood are wearing gloves and changing them often and wiping down everyone's arms and everything donors touch and using, you know, sterile collection sets for every donation. So we're encouraging people to still come and donate blood because that's really important.
Yeah, these are just some of the questions we've been receiving from listeners. If you have a question, please let us know at hereandnow.org, and we'll answer them in the days to come. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein, thank you so much for your time.
You bet. No problem.
What role should the U.S. military play in the COVID-19 pandemic? The military has two fronts to think about. Troops have to be kept safe and healthy, but should they also help Americans be safe at home? Dr. Jonathan Woodson is the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. He coordinated the military's response to Ebola. So, Dr. Woodson, start with that first prong. How is the military preparing to keep its troops safe?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, force health protection, which is a term we use, dates back to really the beginning of the military forces in this country in 1775, where we tried to protect troops against infectious disease. And in the current pandemic, if you look at the experience and some of the things that have been done in Korea, it's been about protecting the troops, isolation, lockdown, quarantine, stop travel orders to prevent the spread. So there is a lot of concern. Remember, we can't defend the nation without people. And historically, disease and non-battle injury has been the major reason that soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines have been taken out of the fight. So we focus on that very heavily to prevent troops from becoming infected and being a source of infection for the general population.
Yeah, and what about the sense of how the military can play a role in the outbreak as it happens? We see the National Guard going to a town in upstate New York to help with kind of a lockdown there in New Rochelle, New York, and to help guide people through the outdoor testing lines. We see pictures of the military making testing kits, rushing to put those through. How else do you think the military can be put to work in the U.S. and not make people feel as if they're under some kind of martial law?
Right. So, you know, there is this law called the Posse Comitatus Act, which actually prevents federal troops from being used against citizens of the United States. And so we have to be very careful about how we employ particularly federal troops. As you may know, though, the state National Guard is under the jurisdiction of the governor. Right now, as we speak, in 19 states, the governors have mobilized some portion of the National Guard to assist with efforts, as you've outlined. So that's one way. That's one level. On a larger scale, there is the capacity for the United States military under federal jurisdiction, again, at the request of the state governors under emergency requests for help, to assist with a large number of activities. The military is excellent at logistics and moving people and supplies from place to place. There are national stockpiles that can be released to support resupply of hospitals. There are other engineering and logistical activities that can support the development of temporary shelters. And on a personnel level, there's the potential for use of military medical personnel to augment healthcare activities across the nation.
It sounds like you're noting some of the things that others have called for. Former Vice President Joe Biden, now the candidate, said the military has hospital beds and tents that could be put to use. You mentioned stockpiles. Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York has called for the Army Corps of Engineers to help retrofit facilities or even build facilities so that they could have more hospital beds. He's talked about commandeering New York University college dorm rooms, and he said, if I had the Army Corps of Engineers, they could build. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, yes, in general. We have to be careful about the specifics, though, because, of course, the Army Corps of Engineers really subcontracts to other, generally, civilian contractors to get the work done. But there are assets within the military that, when we deploy overseas and forward operating bases need to be built, can build things. And, of course, within the inventory of the military, we do have lots of tents and deployable medical facilities that might be used potentially. But the truth of the matter is that you have to have a real strategy for how you're going to employ the military. And it what might seem to be the best strategy on the surface may not be the best strategy when you're looking at sustaining the effort over whatever period of time this pandemic will be with us. What we do is have a repository of very skilled medics that might be employed to run basically assessment stations or, in fact, some of these drive-through activities. They have great skills in terms of basic care of patients, and so you could mobilize perhaps a workforce that could support and free up other personnel to take care of sicker people or routine cases that normally come into the hospital, because people will get appendicitis, people will get injured. Patients shouldn't suffer during the crisis. You have to free up those personnel.
Dr. Jonathan Woodson, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Dr. Woodson, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And by the way, Dr. Woodson also leads Boston University's Institute for Health System Innovation and Policy. And we should say there are reports today that the U.S. military is preparing hospital ships for deployment to open the test labs that are on the ships so people can come in and be tested. The Wall Street Journal has one such report. But today, New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that the Trump administration has directed one of those hospital ships from the military to New York's harbor. We'll have more reporting on this throughout the day.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Most of us are tied to the TV, the web, or the radio, hopefully here and now, to get the latest information on the coronavirus. But for smaller cities and towns without hyper-local news services, we sometimes call them news deserts, the options for timely news, especially during a crisis, are far and few between. We wanted to check in on Malheur County in eastern Oregon, an area that relies heavily on its local paper. It's where the Malheur Enterprise is providing around-the-clock coverage, and the small newspaper staff there is working around-the-clock to cover this coronavirus outbreak. For more, let's bring in Les Zeitz, editor and publisher of the Malheur Enterprise. Les, welcome to Here and Now.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
First off, Les, how are you doing?
That's a pretty general question. We're all running very hard right now.
Yeah. You send an editor's note out to your subscribers. You want it to lay out for the public how your newspaper is taking on this tremendous task of updating. Tell us more.
Well, yeah, we serve a remote part of Oregon, population of about 30,000. The developments, as you know, in the coronavirus outbreak are coming not only by the hour, but by the minute. And so we are striving mightily with three reporters to stay on top of our local developments. But also there's such a torrent of information at all levels that we've collaborated with about a dozen other newsrooms to share content.
Yeah, I know you all also use Facebook as a tool for disseminating information. Has there been any feedback in terms of what the public wants to know about COVID-19?
We use Facebook, frankly, as our AP service out to our readership. But it also gives us a chance to take a temperature reading. We noticed for several days as we started driving out coverage that we were getting a number of remarks from people who were very dismissive of the news about the outbreak. We even had a local police chief who said, "You can't believe what you read in the media." But it does allow us to sort of keep a bit of a finger on the pulse to the county when we're already driving so hard to stay on top of the news.
Right. I mean, three reporters. I'm wondering how your staff is holding up. You know, they live and work there. How are they holding up?
Well, they're holding up very well. We had a staff conference, and I made clear to all of our employees that their health and well-being is number one. But look, this is an unprecedented story. You know, I've been a journalist in Oregon for 45 years. I've covered a lot of major stories, and this will eclipse them all before we are done with it. So the risk is that we go very hard now and run out of steam, and we don't have the ability when this thing really ramps up, or we try to moderate our coverage but pace ourselves.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you were a longtime investigative journalist. You were supposed to retire by now, but you actually decided to take on this paper in 2015. You know, I can only imagine it's because, you know, it's in your bones and you care about being able to give people the information they need. But what is it that you want people to know about your efforts to make certain that people are informed there?
The number one job of the media at this point is that we have to regain the trust of the American people. And so at the Enterprise, I've tried to establish a rapport with the community that makes it clear that our efforts are to provide them fair, accurate information. And people have responded very strongly to that. It has allowed us to succeed and allows us to do what we're doing today.
That's Les Zeitz, editor and publisher of the Malheur Enterprise. Les, thank you.
Okay, bye.
With the coronavirus closing movie theaters around the country, new films may now have a difficult time finding an audience. One movie that's coming out is Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. It's a New York Times critic's pick and a Wall Street Journal pick as well. It calls it exquisitely tender. The film stars Sydney Flanagan as Autumn, a 17-year-old girl living in rural Pennsylvania who is dealing with a surprise pregnancy, and her fears that she might be pregnant are confirmed at a local clinic.
That looks like a positive.
If it's positive, is there any way it could be negative?
No. A positive is always a positive.
The clinic encourages Autumn to have the child, but she and her cousin Skylar, played by Talia Ryder, decide to travel to New York City to get an abortion. The journey proves to be much more difficult than either girl anticipates, and I recently spoke with the film's stars, along with the writer-director Eliza Hittman, and I started by asking Eliza about the research she did for this movie.
Yeah, I started in Pennsylvania, and I went to a lot of pregnancy care centers, and I wanted to really get a better understanding of who those women are, those women who volunteer, you know, in these centers that have a very clear agenda and are anti-reproductive rights. And then I went to clinics in New York also and sat with social workers and at Planned Parenthood and just tried to understand what was happening on the other end of the journey.
This is a very interesting process to take, because this is not a traditional way that filmmakers often go about their films unless they're doing documentary filmmaking.
I think I'm envious of that process, but of course I'm a fiction filmmaker, and the approach that I take is much more subjective and character-driven.
I want to bring in Sydney and Talia now, but first I want to listen to another scene from early in the film. It's of Autumn and Skylar at the grocery store where they both work, and Skylar's been noticing that Autumn doesn't seem to be feeling well. Let's listen.
What's wrong?
World problems.
Bad cramps.
Yeah.
I get those too. Pretty much run through a bottle of painkillers like every month.
Yeah, same.
Don't you ever just wish you were a dude?
All the time.
Sydney Flanagan, this is your first feature film. You're originally a singer. I'm wondering, did you have any fears or any thoughts that were really weighing heavily on you in taking on this role?
Yeah, I mean, when I was approached to do it and I read the script, I was immediately drawn to it. I was like, this is an issue that I've already knew much about, and taking it on felt like a responsibility, but one that I wanted to be a part of, because I, you know, sometimes you feel so helpless, you know, when all these issues are facing you and you don't know what you can really do to help. So being a part of this felt like it was a way I could use my abilities to, you know, tell the story.
Talia, you play Skylar, Autumn's cousin, and both of you are really trying to navigate this extremely heavy situation, and you serve as your cousin's confidant and right hand as you navigate this process of getting an abortion. Your relationship felt pretty authentic. Were there any surprises for you in preparing for this role?
Well, in our preparation for the film, the primary focus was to solidify mine and Sydney's relationship with each other as people rather than just as characters. We had a very short rehearsal process. We had 2 days to kind of get to know each other and get to know the script. And we spent those 2 days kind of doing bonding exercises, just spending time with each other, asking questions about the script to Eliza, and just going through scenes and getting comfortable with everything.
Eliza, we have clues, but we never really learn who got Autumn pregnant. In a way, it doesn't matter when you're watching this film, but why did you decide to tell the story this way?
I think for me, I was interested in making the film about the active crisis. So for me, it was very much about her pursuit to get this abortion, and that was the main narrative that I wanted to focus on. And, you know, I really wanted to allude to, you know, who the father could be more than confront it. And I think I wanted to really give the audience a sense that the atmosphere around these women is hostile. And that was more important to me, the tension in the environment, than implicating one character particularly as the father.
The title of your movie comes from a scene in one of the clinics that Autumn goes to. She's questioned by a social worker about her sexual history, and it's through those questions that we actually learn a lot about Autumn. I read that the woman who asks the questions of Autumn is actually a real social worker who was a consultant on the film.
Yeah, it wasn't my idea from the beginning of the casting process. I just kept consulting with Kelly Chapman, who is a social worker. She trained at Planned Parenthood and worked at a clinic in Queens called Choices, which is where I met her. While we were casting, we went through a lot of ideas of who this social worker could be. And, you know, we had some incredible actresses on those lists and really thought about what it would be like. But in the end, you know, for the type of story I was telling and for the intimacy of the scene and the authenticity that I wanted, I really couldn't imagine anyone but Kelly. My fear was that an actor might upstage in a way or distract from the film.
Yeah. Eliza, why do you think it's important to tell a story like this now?
You know, I think we were, talking a little bit about documentaries earlier. I think it's often hard, you know, for women to come forward and be subjects in those kinds of films and talk about their personal experience. It's still such a stigmatized and taboo subject. And I think within the context of a fiction film, we're able to give a voice to the voiceless and a face to the faceless. And, you know, I think the film is incredibly timely, and it's a journey that many women take.
We've been speaking about the new film Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always with writer-director Eliza Hittman and stars Sydney Flanagan and Talia Ryder. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As more people test positive for the new coronavirus, more who aren't severely ill are being told to quarantine at home. But enforcing that can be a challenge, one some local governments are struggling with. St. Louis Public Radio's Eli Chen reports on how decades-old quarantine policies have left some states unprepared for the COVID-19 outbreak.
It was on March 7th that Missouri health officials confirmed the state's first case of COVID-19, a 20-year-old St. Louis County woman who had been studying abroad in Italy. After the eldest daughter tested positive, county health officials say they told family members to quarantine themselves, though the family disputes that. The woman's father took her sister to a high school dance. That led to this news conference with county executive Sam Page.
The county health directors informed him today that he must remain in his home, or they will issue a formal quarantine that will require him and the rest of his family to stay in their home by the force of law.
In some cases, the federal government may have the authority to quarantine people with communicable diseases. On Monday, President Trump recommended that families of people with COVID-19 should stay inside. But that's just a recommendation. It's often left up to state and local officials to figure out when and how to enforce someone to isolate themselves. When a 53-year-old Kentucky man who tested positive for COVID-19 refused to self-isolate, state officials there obtained a court order to force him to do so and even posted a police officer outside of his house. Here's Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear on that decision.
It's a step I hope that I never had to take, but we can't allow one person who we know has this virus to refuse to protect their neighbors.
Legally mandated quarantines have rarely been used in the U.S. In most states, people can face fines and even criminal charges if they defy a court-ordered quarantine. But Northeastern University law professor Wendy Parmet says threats of arrest and other penalties aren't effective at protecting community health, and that states need to revise policies to help address why a person might break quarantine.
So one thing I think is important is that before we condemn people, we need to know a little bit more about what's going on, what is their story, what message are they getting. There's just a lot of confusion right now.
Many state governments haven't updated their quarantine laws in decades, and fewer than half have plans to ensure safe and humane quarantines. Boston University law professor Michael Ulrich says quarantines imposed during the 2014 Ebola outbreak led to lots of problems.
And there are a lot of stories of students being trapped in their, you know, 300-square-foot studio apartment with trash piling up, and they're running out of food, and the states weren't really prepared.
Many state policies don't address how people will be able to acquire food and medicine to help them quarantine at home. And only 20% of states have policies that protect a person's employment while they are under quarantine. Getting a court order to force someone to quarantine could be counterproductive. Ulrich says asking someone to voluntarily self-quarantine fosters more trust between the general public and government officials.
And then you get people that feel more like they're in control and like they are deciding to stay home rather than being coerced or forced to.
And he says with voluntary requests, it's more likely that people will tell the truth about their symptoms, because relying on someone's goodwill just may not be enough. For NPR News, I'm Eli Chen.
New disease spread simulations from Harvard show that every corner of this country is at risk of a severe shortage of hospital beds as the coronavirus outbreak escalates. All hospital systems are bracing, and Steward Healthcare, which has 35 hospitals in 9 states, is moving toward making one of its hospitals, Kearney Hospital in Boston, coronavirus only, starting with one floor. Dr. Joseph Weinstein is chief medical officer at Steward Healthcare. So, Dr. Weinstein, what does this look and feel like?
So first, I think this has been the result of a very comprehensive approach to planning for the disease. It began months ago with stockpiling of resources to make sure we had adequate equipment and supplies to care for patients. And now we have also retrofitted one floor in this hospital. And the key to the retrofit has been making sure that every room has negative pressure. Hmm. Negative pressure means that the air in the room is essentially removed, almost like a vacuum cleaner, and it is basically filtered through a HEPA filter. And then that air is eliminated in a way that it cannot cause contamination or further infection with other patients.
Well, hold on a second, because we want to be clear. We understood that the coronavirus was spread through droplets when people either sneezed or coughed. And, you know, they could go maybe 6 feet a distance. You're saying they could be in air vents?
No, I'm not saying they can be in air vents. I'm saying that we remove the air through air vents. We don't allow those droplets to basically stay in the air. We're actually removing the air in that unit with essentially a vacuum cleaner. We're vacuuming the air, for lack of a better word. But we're removing the air, and the entire unit is under negative pressure.
Wow. That's protective for health workers, especially, I would imagine.
Yes, ma'am. It's protective for health workers, for people who might be, you know, again, in the environment. And again, for patients who, you know, we want to remove those droplets from the air so that that air is as fresh as it can possibly be.
And then what else? We know that many of these more severe patients need ventilators. There's been a shortage of ventilators. I'm sure you need hazardous material, suits and equipment for the healthcare workers. Would that be a part of this planning, I'm assuming?
Yes, ma'am. So we've certainly begun stockpiling all the personal protective equipment that people need. We have gowns and gloves and masks and face shields. And again, the entire process of putting that equipment on and removing it safely, known as donning and doffing, is something that our staff has basically been working on to ensure that they're doing it correctly so as to minimize the risk to themselves. And we also, again, have been making sure we have adequate amounts of breathing equipment, including non-invasive ventilation and ventilator machines.
Yeah.
In addition to the one floor that we've designated at Kearney Hospital with the 11 beds, we also have an intensive care unit there, again, equipped with negative pressure so that it can manage patients who might require treatment in the intensive care unit if conservative treatment on the floor doesn't allow those patients to get back to the type of clinical outcomes that we'd like.
Or I would imagine if some of them had other problems and you didn't want to move them around the hospital. And we see on Kearney's webpage that you're already restricting visitors. Many hospitals are. This is reminding us of some of us of another time. We spoke to Tenley Albright this week, the Olympic skater who was also a polio survivor, who spoke of being in a hospital and her parents brought her brother to climb up a stepladder so that she could see him. And we're seeing pictures now of, you know, a granddaughter going up to a window, her grandfather's being treated, and she's outside the window holding up her engagement ring so he can see it. I mean, we are at that time.
We are at that time, and we are extraordinarily cautious about the fact that visitors are not going to be able to see patients. But restricting visitors at this point is an extension of the social distancing, which many of us have been talking about, to try and prevent the spread of the disease and to try and prevent more people from becoming infected. So social distancing, you know, is extraordinarily important. And limiting visitation really is an extension of that to make sure that we don't allow this disease to spread any more than it already has.
Yeah. How do you get healthcare workers to, how does it work? Do they volunteer to be on this ward? Are they told they have to? What extraordinary work they're doing? How do you single out who does it?
So some people have volunteered. Some people are just scheduled to work on the unit. We're extraordinarily proud of our workforce, which, you know, is in our emergency rooms seeing these patients. It's, you know, in our floors, in our intensive care units. You know, many people have dedicated their entire careers to healthcare. And while this is certainly probably the most famous infectious disease issue we've seen, you know, people have been prepared and trained to deal with this. Many people remember HIV in the early 90s when people were very afraid to care for those patients. So this is not unique, but again, it's just a reflection of truly how heroic our health workers are. And I don't think one should exclude our EMTs and other people who are on the front lines of caring for people in the community.
Dr. Joseph Weinstein is Chief Medical Officer at Kearney Hospital, part of Steward Healthcare. They run 35 hospitals in 9 states, and they're going to begin retrofitting one floor of Kearney to treat coronavirus patients only. Dr. Weinstein, thank you, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, and again, thank you for having me.
More than a dozen American journalists could be expelled from China in retaliation for a new limit the Trump administration imposed on visas for Chinese state-owned media here in the U.S. China announced yesterday that Americans working at the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post must surrender their press cards within 10 days. And those journalists will most certainly have to leave the country because their visas are tied to their media credentials. NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam is following this story and joins us now. And Jackie, this feels like a media war. What started it?
Well, I think some would argue that rather than a media war, journalists are being used as pawns in this broader geopolitical struggle between the U.S. and China. But as far as the media becoming embroiled in it, it goes back several weeks. In February, China expelled 3 journalists from the Wall Street Journal because of a critical article by one of its columnists. And shortly after that, the Trump administration designated 5 Chinese state-run media outlets here in the U.S. as foreign entities. And a short while later, the administration slashed the number of Chinese state journalists working for those organizations. And then, of course, the news that China was expelling more U.S. journalists. So it's been a sort of tit-for-tat situation, and who knows if this is the end of it.
So just to be clear, this has nothing to do with the coronavirus
or I'm just thinking about the news outlets' coverage of it.
Not directly, but yesterday Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had a press conference, and it kind of got intermingled. He said he regretted China's decision to hinder the world's ability to conduct free press operations during what he called an incredibly challenging global time. And he said where more information and more transparency could save lives. So Pompeo didn't specifically say the coronavirus outbreak, but the implication was there, certainly.
I see. Do any of the American newspapers have any recourse in this?
It's difficult to say. China's foreign ministry today faced a room full of pretty angry journalists in Beijing. And the foreign ministry said its decision to expel the American journalists was a direct retaliation for the Trump administration capping the number of Chinese journalists here in the U.S. A foreign ministry spokesperson urged the U.S. to, quote, correct its mistake. There are still some details about the ban that also have to be sorted out. For example, will it extend to reporting in places like Macau and Hong Kong, which are semi-autonomous regions? So it's unclear how Beijing will enforce that ban.
Yeah. We were talking about the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post reporters. But what's going to happen to any of the other American reporters also working in China?
You're right. I mean, there are many U.S.-based media outlets, including NPR and CNN, AP, that all have bureaus in China and Hong Kong. And so far, none of these organizations are named in this order. But the order does suggest that there could be further action taken against American journalists. So it's unclear how many more U.S. journalists will affect.
Yeah. In the 30 seconds I have with you, what does this say more broadly, really, about our relationship with China?
I think that the relationship is continuing to dissolve. You know, this comes at a time when countries all over the world are trying to contain the coronavirus outbreak. And you have the two economic superpowers hurling insults at each other and expelling journalists. And you see both tried to blame the other for the crisis. And it's just hard to say how productive all this is, you know, at a time when the world is trying to deal with the pandemic.
That's NPR's international affairs correspondent, Jackie Northam. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
And we've been reporting on the Trump administration's actions to curb the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. And a big question has been, are those measures enough? Andy Slavitt is the former acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in the Obama administration. And he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yes, great to have you. So you have been very vocal about the government's interventions to stop the spread of this virus. I want to get to those in a moment, but you and a dozen healthcare leaders penned this open letter in USA Today, and a big part of what you're driving home is the need to protect local and state leaders and healthcare workers who are on the front lines of this. And I want to know, what more would you like to see being done at this stage in the fight?
Well, the real hard part is going to be focused on our frontline healthcare workforce. In many ways, over the next 18 months, they're going to be a lot like a deployed military force. And I think the most important way we can support them is through this initiative, this hashtag stay home, save lives. Because the only real thing we can do to prevent them from being overwhelmed and being able to take care of sick people is if we don't spread this condition ourselves. And I think if we buckle down and understand that it's just a period of time, we can do some real good. If we don't, the cost in casualties is going to be quite high.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the task force briefing yesterday. And in that briefing, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said that the unemployment rate could jump to 20% if Congress doesn't pass a $1 trillion stimulus package. And you've said that this could be an opportunity to build a new public health sector. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think when all is said and done, it's going to have to look more like $3 trillion than $1 trillion. And I don't mean this critically of the administration, because at this point in time, we all want them to succeed. But they're a little bit always a step behind and a dollar short. And because of the way this disease spreads, i.e. exponentially, it's hard for people to get their hands around the math. but we need to be able to sustain people for up to 18 months at home. And if there is 20% unemployment, then it gives us a great opportunity to start to build the things we probably should have built before: stockpiles of medication, stockpiles of surgical equipment, things that support our healthcare workforce and industry. It's a radical change. You know, we haven't made things in this country in quite some time.
A long time. Well, I want to ask more about that, the volume of equipment. I mean, it's such a critical issue right now, specifically ventilators and respirators. Those are a big concern. Yesterday, President Trump said this.
And yesterday, I gave the governors the right to go order directly if they want, if they feel they can do it faster than going through the federal government.
Andy, you're talking about strategy, about the government taking a look at ways to build things that then we will use for a long time coming from now. Is this the best way that the president is talking about to ensure that states get the equipment they need by just leaving it up to them?
Well, he's between a rock and a hard place because, you know, nobody planned for this. But the truth is, we have to operate from where we are, not where we wish we were. And where we are is we do have these shortages. So the president, I think, he hasn't been telling the truth necessarily in everything he said. But in that particular case, I think what he's saying is we don't have a magic large stockpile of ventilators. They have some. And he needs to be much quicker about getting those out to people where they're needed. And they need to coordinate where the ventilators are so we have them in the most important places. But we can't overnight make 400,000 or 500,000 ventilators, which is what we could need.
One thing that struck me that you said earlier was that we're all in this together and we want to see this administration succeed. But what are your thoughts on the leadership of President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence in the midst of this pandemic? Or should we even be thinking in those terms right now?
Well, I went through a period of time at the beginning of this when we had a chance to contain it, where I was very, very critical of the president and the vice president, because I think some of the original sin here was him calling this a hoax. And we could have had a South Korea type response if Trump hadn't viewed this as something that was targeted at his reelection. I tell you that I put that aside. I don't think those right now for me are productive feelings. We are all in this together. You know, as far as I know, this virus spreads from Republican to Democrat and Democrat to Republican. And so this can't be seen as political. The smartest thing Trump could do right now is to call President Obama on the phone and ask him to do a joint public service announcement with him and say, this is beyond the politics. Now, we'll get back to the politics. I look forward to the day when we get back to the politics and hold people to account. In the meantime, we need to do everything we can because the government's overwhelmed, the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed, and it will be completely unconstructive, in my view, to spend my energy or much other energy attacking for attacking's sake.
That's Andy Slavitt, the former acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under the Obama administration. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.